as the culmination of a long feud. Terribly, the boundless sea echoed all around, and the earth roared loudly, wide heaven groaned, shaking, and great Olympus, throne of the gods, shook from its foundation under the charge of the deathless ones. And heavy quaking reached gloomy Tartarus, the underworld, and the sharp pounding of feet in the ineffable rush of their mighty blows. For thus they hurled at each other their baleful missiles, and the cry of both sides reached the starry sky as they bellowed, and they came together with a great battle shout. Nor did Zeus still hold back his might, but now, indeed, suddenly his mind was filled with rage, and he showed forth his whole strength, and altogether from the sky and from Olympus he came, hurling lightning continuously, and the bolts flew thickly amid thunder and flashing from his powerful hand, whirling swiftly with sacred flame. All around the life-giving earth resounded, burning, and all around the great boundless woods crackled with fire. The entire land seethed, as did the stream of ocean and the harvestless sea. The hot blast surrounded the earth-born titans, and a boundless flame reached the bright upper air. The gleam blinded their eyes, for all that they were strong, as it flashed with lightning and sparks. A supernatural heat seized the yawning void, and it seemed, facing it, seeing with the eyes and hearing the sound with the ears, just as if earth and wide heaven above collided, for so huge a boom would roll forth if earth were being hurled up, while sky were falling down from above. Just such a din arose from the deities colliding in strife, and the winds brought together quakes and dust clouds, and thunderclaps and lightning and smoking thunderbolts, and there in the forefront they stirred up the sharp fight. Kotos and Briareos and Gyges, insatiable in battle, 300 rocks from their stalwart hands in quick succession they launched, and with their missiles overshadowed the Titans, and under broad-pathed earth they sent them, and bound them in grievous chains, conquering them with their hands despite their audacity, so far beneath the earth as sky is above it. Hesiod, Theogony. Noise and quakes, missiles, lightning and thunder, fire and terrible heat, then a huge shaft of fire going sky high, an indescribably loud noise, more flying rocks, and finally everything ending up as far below the surface as it had been above it. That's just about what the geologists reconstruct for Thera. In fact, Mott Green, recognizing a volcano like Thera as unlike any other in its specific eruption pattern, lines up the precise sequence of events in Hesiod and those reconstructed from the geology of Thera, thus demonstrating that this account could refer only to Thera, out of the whole Mediterranean volcanic zone. His table of events, starting about 50 lines before the Hesiod passage quoted before, is as follows, comparing the sequence of events in Hesiod to those reconstructed from the geological record of Thera. A long war, compared to premonitory seismicity. Both sides gather strength, compared to increased activity. Terrible echoes over sea, compared to first phase explosions. Ground rumbles loudly, compared to tectonic earthquakes. Sky shakes and groans, compared to air shock waves. Mount Olympus trembles, compared to great earthquakes. Steady vibrations of ground, compared to earthquakes. Weapons whistle through air, compared to pyroclastic ejecta. Loud battle cries, compared to explosive reports. Zeus arrives, lightning, thunder, fields, forests burn, compared to volcanic lightning, heat of ignimbrites. earth and sea boil compared to magma chamber breach. Immense flame and heat compared to freedom magmatic explosion. Green explains this term and phenomenon thus. If the volcano in question is an island, and if the magma chamber is breached while the magma is still being erupted, the violence of the explosion can be many times magnified by the vaporization of inrushing seawater coming into contact with the incandescent magma in a so-called freedomagmatic eruption, akin to the explosion of a giant steam boiler. Sound of earth and sky collapse compared to sound of freedomagmatic explosion. Dust, lightning, thunder, wind compared to final ash eruptions. And finally, titans buried under missiles compared to collapsed debris. Green also distinguishes this list from the characteristic patterns of the other active Mediterranean volcanoes like Vesuvius, Stromboli, and Etna, the last of which finds its characteristic signature in the very next battle that Hesiod reports, Zeus versus Typhoeus. For the heavy involvement of Zeus's lightning in both battles, compare, in addition to passages already quoted, the account by a group rowing a boat on a lake in a pitch-black cloud of ash, trying to escape an eruption of Calbuco, Chile, in 1929. We were wrapped in the fire of St. Elmo, produced by the high electric tension. From our clothes and flesh we gave off sparks, and our heads seemed to be surrounded with aureoles. Suddenly the lightning flashed, followed immediately by thunder. Simultaneously, the discharges from our bodies stopped. And as Mount Pelée in Martinique was revving up in 1902, the governor wrote of the electrical charge being so intense as to render the telephone operator's work almost impossible. Returning to Thera, we find a quite plausible Group D ash cloud account in the following passage, from 600 miles to the southeast, just the direction the ash cloud headed, to judge from the geology. And there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did any rise from his place for 3 days. Exodus 10. This passage, containing the Egyptian darkness referred to by the Loudon passenger, is followed soon after by the description of Moses' people making their way out of Egypt. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Exodus 13. Anyone who has watched an eruption or big brush fire can tell you that the bright sunlight overwhelms the glow of lava and fire when you view it from afar, so it looks dark. What is visually prominent is the great cloud of smoke and ash rising from it. But the moment the sun goes down, you can see the fire with startling clarity from great distances. In short, an eruption typically looks dark in the daytime and glows fiery bright at night. That this scene pertains to a gigantic eruption is underscored by the very next event to happen, the tsunami-like parting of the waters that allows Moses and his flock to pass, then closes over their pursuers. For people moving north down the Nile Valley to where the delta opens out, an eruption pillar over Thera would indeed be ahead of them. But whether the exodus as described actually occurred in 1625 BC is another matter. We will see in a later chapter that time often gets foreshortened in the retelling of myths, with different stories that have some points of resemblance, analogies, getting conflated into one narrative. Thus, Exodus, as we have it, may contain details from several different time periods, several different trips out of Egypt. The Theran tsunami may also well account for the tidal wave already mentioned that Poseidon reportedly sent against Athens, the one Athena stopped at the foot of the Acropolis, 5 kilometers inland. Another Group C description of the ash pillar from Thera probably lies fossilized in the Hittite myth of Ulikumi. A defeated deity named Kumarbi begets the rebel Ulikumi to challenge the storm god Teshub, also Kumarbi's son, who had displaced him as king of heaven. We'll hear more about this in chapter 16. And plants the child on the shoulder of the ancient being who supports the world, Ubeluri. The young giant grows up from the sea with tremendous speed till he is 9,000 leagues tall. Terrified at his sudden appearance, the gods struggle to defeat the bellowing monster, but in vain. In fact, at one point they fear Ulikumi has overpowered the storm god himself. Finally, Ea, the god of wisdom, goes to Ubeluri, who complains that he lives in so remote a region that he knows nothing of what happens in the world. "When they built heaven and earth upon me, I knew nothing. But when they came and they cut heaven and earth apart with a cutter, this too I knew not. Now something makes my right shoulder hurt, but I know not who he is, this god." When Ea heard those words, he went around Ubaluri's right shoulder, and there the basalt stood on Ubaluri's right shoulder like a shaft. Then the gods get the bright idea of fetching the ancient cutter, variously described elsewhere as an adamantine blade or sickle, with which earth and sky had been sliced apart at the beginning of time, and of using it to sever the burgeoning monster at the feet. Although the text is fragmentary and we have no ending, apparently the rebel is vanquished, presumably by this ruse of cutting asunder from earth what is reaching sky. Turkey is far closer to Thera than Egypt, and the enormously tall ash pillar, standing on the shoulder of the world, with its feet in the ocean and bellowing, must have been visible from many high points, just as the column above Mount St. Helens in southern Washington could be seen easily from Mount Rainier near Seattle in the north. Eventually, of course, the ash pillar that seems rooted to the earth separates from the bottom, once no more ejecta are being fed into it, and then it slowly disperses. Volcanism has disturbed human life since our species came into being. Quakes, tsunamis, explosions, lava flows, ash blankets, and so forth. Except for the occasional meteorites and asteroids that hit the Earth, such as those that flattened the Tungus forests in 1908, or hit Yucatan and extinguished both the dinosaurs and the Cretaceous era 65 million years ago, seismic upheavals are about the strongest forces of nature that humans face. All such catastrophic events will constitute important information for descendants to know about, and hence will turn up in mythology in considerable numbers. But most important of all to warn about, precisely because one can pinpoint the exact source of trouble, is a volcano. In California, everyone knows about the San Andreas Fault, but when a quake occurs, it is unlocalizable. It just happens. Everything in your house shakes equally. There are, in fact, thousands of smaller faults in all directions, any one of which could be the source of this quake, and you need modern technology to find the epicenter by triangulating from three seismometers or three radio or television stations. We've learned that if we can find and tune to a television station between us and the source, we have an early warning system for the long series of aftershocks. The studio reporters yell, we grab a doorpost. Tsunamis and ash clouds, too, often come from sufficiently far away that, without technology, the source may be unknown, so that one such event comes to sound much like another. But witnessing a volcanic eruption directly is different. You know where it comes from, you can see it, and it runs its course with no more than a generic resemblance to other eruptions. It has all the uniqueness of thou. So myths generated by volcanoes tend to be quite specific and idiosyncratic, and more numerous than most other classes of myth. Furthermore, an eruption leaves layers of debris that are both decipherable and datable, especially for volcanoes that erupt only rather seldom, like most of those in the Mediterranean and the Pacific Northwest. Thus, geologists and archaeologists have a fighting chance of pinning down the sources and dates of the myths engendered. Even the incessant eruptions of Kilauea are now being correlated to the Hawaiian genealogical chants, which span a millennium. Volcano myths can in this way give back a measure of history to the prehistoric. Chapter 9. Views Through Biased Lenses. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all? The Queen in Snow White. Fairest of them all affect. People tend to select and pass down the view or version of events that puts themselves in the best light, and enemies in the worst light. Remembering is always transformation and reconstruction. Jan Osman, 1997. When a natural event like an eruption propagates myths among different cultures, the differences of viewpoint are largely geographical. But viewpoints can become quite personal and cultural when the event has been generated by humans, a battle or a migration, for instance. People like to look good, especially to their friends and relations. So the self-same battle may sound entirely different in the clan histories of the two opposing sides. Thus, we find that both the Hittites and the Egyptians claimed victory at the Battle of Kadesh, fought in 1275 BC around the Syrian city of Kadesh. Each side describes in glowing terms the total discomfiture of the other. Yet outside evidence shows it to have been something of a draw. Readers of ancient Egyptian war reports soon notice, in fact, that Pharaoh seems always to win his battles, and we begin to take such reports with a whole spoonful of salt. A famous recasting of history to one's own glory occurs in the medieval poem Le Chanson de Roland, The Song of Roland, in which Roland leads Charlemagne's rear guard in a heroic stand against 100,000 heathen Saracens. The book-length epic details how Roland and his brave troops fall down to the last man to allow their king to escape the treacherous attack as they cross the Pyrenees back to France after a parley with the wicked Saracens. Other records indicate, however, that in 778, Charlemagne's small rear guard led by Roland was wiped out by a local band of Basque sheepherders. Cognitive scientists studying memory find, in fact, that self-enhancing biases are pervasive features of attempts to reconstruct the personal past. Furthermore, cultural memories are invariably distorted by the biases of the cultural group, whether glorifications or other fostered images. At a time when literature was oral and communal, its recitation promoted, among other things, communal solidarity. Twice in the Song of Roland, someone says starkly, "Pagans are wrong, Christians are right." And Aristophanes' main point in The Frogs was that Athens no longer had any tragedians who could whip up the necessary public solidarity in the theaters to win the war against Sparta. Because they are promoted, we are told, the culturally valued and memorialized activities are more easily retrievable than culturally denigrated, repressed, or stigmatized activities. And just as experiments have shown that adults remember from their own lives not what they experienced, but what they learn they are conventionally supposed to have experienced, so cultural memories become structured, retained or obliterated, according to the many values of the society. Michael Shudson calls this process conventionalization and lists it as one of four typical ways in which cultural memory becomes distorted. Another he calls narrativization, which he describes as an effort not only to report the past, but to make it interesting by getting it encapsulated into some sort of cultural form, usually a narrative. But as he puts it, narratives simplify. You can't cram absolutely everything that actually happened into a good story, or it becomes hopelessly cluttered and tedious. So you pick and choose, according, among other things, to the process of conventionalization, and the rest drops into the river of forgetfulness. The third process Shudson calls instrumentalization, pointing out that often memory selects and distorts in the service of present interests, where present interest may be strategic, propagandistic, or semiotic, in the service simply of trying to understand one's world. Most of the myths cited so far in this book have been of the latter sort, whereas myths entangled in the fairest of them all effect are generally strategic. Looking at the evidence from myth, one might add a third source of present interest, communal emotions. Jan Osman, for example, gives a very shrewd analysis of the Hebrew memory of the Exodus and the Egyptian memory of the Hyksos as being emotionally, as well as strategically and semiotically, opposing views of the same events. The Egyptians tell how the Hyksos from the Levant invaded Egypt and ruled it for centuries with great cruelty to the natives, until the Egyptians rose up and expelled them at sword point back to the Levant. The Old Testament, for its part, relates how the Egyptians held the children of Israel in cruel captivity for centuries, until the latter rose up and escaped with great difficulty back to the Levant, pursued by the Egyptian army. In both cases, a group from the Levant came into Egypt, lived there for a while under hostile circumstances, and returned to the Levant. And in both accounts, as Osman says, the most striking feature is the strong attitude of hatred, fear, and abomination which pervades. Each group casts themselves as the heroic victims, and the other side as the despotic villains. The problem gets even more interesting when Osman looks at a second Egyptian tradition, that recorded by Manetho, early 3rd century BC. Here, a group of lepers is persecuted by the pharaoh, who hopes by cleansing the land to entice back the gods, who have disappeared. The lepers are finally resettled in northern Egypt, whereupon they invite the Hyksos back. Their leader then makes for them laws that prescribe all that is forbidden in Egypt, and forbid all that is prescribed there. The first and foremost commandments are not to worship the gods, not to abstain from their forbidden food, and not to associate with people from outside. Finally, after 13 years of sacrilegious and despotic rule, the lepers and the Hyksos together are driven out by the Egyptians. Osman makes an excellent case that we have here a mythologized memory of the 12-year Amarna period, during which the pharaoh Akhenaten banned the traditional polytheistic state religion and set up the world's first documented monotheistic belief system. As we said in Chapter 7 when discussing heretics, the Egyptians so hated this new religion that when Akhenaten died, they systematically destroyed his name and monuments and utterly obliterated all direct memory of him from the cultural tradition. After much analysis, Osman concludes, "In Manetho's version, it is clear that the presence of the lepers is the cause for the invisibility of the gods. The lepers can thus be identified as a transformation or distortion of the heretics. This becomes even more clear in the continuation of the story. The lepers are shown as religious revolutionaries. The king fears them as such because he makes his preparations by hiding the divine images and rescuing the sacred animals, and they confirm their image by destroying the temples, slashing the remaining idols, and roasting the rest of the sacred animals. The very first of their laws is a religious one, the prohibition to worship the gods. This story of the lepers is about religion." Osman, 1997. It is fascinating that a structurally identical myth about religion grew up in Europe in the Middle Ages, in which the lepers were accused of attempting to poison the wells with leprosy after renouncing Christianity, and of joining with the Jews, Saracens, and witches in these deeds so as to take over rule of the world from the Christians. These accusations, which began in France in 1321, led to a frantic and ever-expanding orgy of burnings and incarcerations, mostly without trial. Again, we see that hatred, fear, and abomination dominate, and that those feared most for disease, lepers, are lumped and equated with those hated most for religious and political otherness. We also see another widely observable principle at work. By blaming the poison conspiracy on the lepers, whom no one dared go near, and who were forced to keep to themselves, rabble-rousers could say anything, and people could believe anything, without being contradicted. And since the Jewish people lived isolated in ghettos, and the hated Saracens way off in Spain, the same was true of them. The Hyksos to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians to the Jewish people, were equally unconsultable. Zone of Convenient Remove Syndrome. People can perpetuate a vivid and seemingly plausible story by telling it of a third party who can't be consulted for verification. This principle, in fact, generates the classic urban legend, where the third party is typically as near as possible while being unreachable. A relative of a friend, or a friend of a relative, or a friend of a friend, FOAF, or simply an enemy. The locus classicus of such stories is the attribution of cannibalism to people who, because they are enemies, are never present to defend themselves against this most inhumanizing of accusations. Thus, as W. Aaron says in his book, The Man-Eating Myth, 1979, in China it was believed Koreans were cannibals, while in Korea the opposite belief prevailed. Similarly, the early Christians were accused by the Romans and the Jews of eating little children, whereas later the Christians accused the Jews of the same. To the extent that these groups were isolated minorities, they were all vulnerable to such calumnies. The glorification of oneself and vilification of others can even lead to portraying others as less than human, not just unclean, but demons or imps. The phenomenon is well attested linguistically as well as mythically. Thus, the Chinese for millennia have called non-Han people foreign devils, while the ancient Greeks called others barbaroi, barbarians, a term thought to come from an onomatopoeic, barbar, for foreigners who could only babble instead of speaking proper Greek. The Egyptians made a distinction between men on the one hand and Libyans or Asiatics or Africans on the other. The word men in that sense meant Egyptians. Otherwise, it meant humans in distinction to the gods, or humans in distinction to animals. In other words, the Egyptians were people, foreigners were not. At a time of national distress, when the stable old order had broken down and social conditions were upside down, there was a complaint that strangers from outside have come into Egypt. Foreigners have become people everywhere. From Wilson, 1949. Many linguistic groups, in fact, call themselves people, the literal translation of Navajo, Hopi, Apache, and Inuit, with the implication that all others are not people. Geography works the same way. China is the Middle Kingdom. The Sumerians put themselves in the middle of their maps, and atlases printed in the United States typically put North America at the top center of the world map, although it requires splitting Eurasia. In mythology, antagonists often turn up as fiends and devils, as the Indic invaders viewed the Dravidian natives, or as the Celts viewed the prior inhabitants of Ireland. And the former occupants of the territory appear as all manner of elves, brownies, and dwarves, hard to find and archaic in their ways. The dwarves of Germanic mythology provide a particularly interesting case. Half-sized, though muscular in stature, these miners with their peaked hats live inside mountains where they forge and hammer their vast treasures of gold, gems, and steel into priceless jewelry, mayhap with a curse attached, and nearly invincible weapons, usually endowed with a name and a willful spirit, which the Germanic hero of the story tries to get from them by trade or trickery. What's that all about? Dolly the camera to the mountainsides of Central Europe, where Bronze Age and Iron Age miners did the first mining in that area, and where their ancient mine shafts still turn up. Archaeologists have found that the late Bronze and early Iron Age mines, roughly 1300 to 400 BC, of Austria and Hungary, were worked by men of the Hallstatt culture, the immediate ancestor of the demonstrably Celtic Latin culture. The Latin Celts began migrating away, primarily westward, about 400 BC. And as the Celtic miners moved out of Central Europe, the Germanic peoples moved into the vacuum. In the mines, we find fragments of plaid twills, quite similar to those associated with Celts still today, tam-o'-shanter-style hats, and peaked hats like those traditionally depicted on the dwarves. Now, back to the camera. You, the early Germanic viewer, have not specialized in the mysteries of mining, and the miners have now left. But you know, these are the snapshots, that the former local populace, who wore pointy hats, would disappear into and reappear from small holes that you can still see in the mountainside, as in the Grimm's tale, The Dwarf Holes, and that they obtained a seemingly unending supply of rich jewelry and wonderful weapons from the mountain. You conclude, here comes the newsreel, that they lived inside the mountain and guarded their treasures there, because that's the place associated with them, that they must have been short because the openings are only a couple of feet high, and muscular because forging all that metal required strength. They must also have known magic to be able to find the gold and gems and make all that glorious stuff, and surely they would have left in irritation or despair only if they had lost all their treasure. No out-and-out proof exists for this theory of the origin of the race of treasure-forging dwarves, nor is any likely to be forthcoming, but the scenario takes care of a remarkably high percentage of otherwise weird and arbitrary details about these interesting characters, and does so by well-attested principles. Chapter 10. Metaphoric Reality, Magic, and Dreams. Or, Who's On First? Principle of Metaphoric Reality. The distinction between representation and referent, and between appearance and reality, tends to become blurred. Your Majesty says, kill a gentleman, and a gentleman is told off to be killed. Consequently, that gentleman is as good as dead. Practically, he is dead. And if he is dead, why not say so? W. S. Gilbert, The Mikado. It is not wax that I am scorching. It is the liver, heart, and spleen of so-and-so that I scorch. Melee Death Charm. Analogy pervades our thinking. What was it like? We ask the survivor, the veteran, the experiencer, the expert. We continually ask for and transmit information via metaphors, similes, and comparisons, especially when the information is so new that no ready-made vocabulary exists yet to describe it. The atom, with its electrons, is structured like the sun with its planets whizzing around it. The eruption sounded like artillery. Going outside was like sticking your head in the fireplace and stirring up the ashes, because the ash blew around like a blizzard, and the city came to look as though the contents of a vacuum cleaner bag had been dumped onto it. Suppose, however, the fact of its being a simile gets lost somehow, either through time or through interpretation. Then the eruption is artillery fire, an enormous battle, or the most horrendous of all storms, depending on what zone you are in. Add a dash of willfulness, and we find the storm god engaged in an apocalyptic battle with some other, very ill-willed force. What may have started out as pure analogy can merge with the event it originally described. The representation merges with the referent. The Sumerians came to believe that lapis lazuli, deep blue like the night sky, and sometimes having tiny, bright, star-like inclusions, was the stuff of which the sanctuary of Middle Heaven was made. Some of the cultural groups living in the American Southwest believed that the House of the Sun was made of turquoise, or that turquoise stole its color from the sky. It's like, therefore it is. Red liquid trails down a mountain like red hair, like snaky locks, like blood. Presently, it is the red hair or snaky locks or blood of a giant. Perhaps the clearest example of this human propensity for blurring representation and referent comes once again from a well-attested linguistic phenomenon, wherein the name, verbal symbol or representation for something, comes to be viewed as tantamount to the thing itself, and power over your name comes to mean power over you yourself. For instance, Fraser reports that in Central Australia, every man, woman, and child has, besides a personal name which is in common use, a secret or sacred name which is bestowed by the older men on him or her soon after birth, and which is known to none but the fully initiated members of the group. This secret name is never mentioned except upon the most solemn occasions, and spoken only in a whisper, and not until the most elaborate precautions have been taken that it shall be heard by no one but members of the group, since a stranger knowing a person's secret name would have special power to work him ill by means of magic. Fraser then reports similar beliefs among the ancient Egyptians, the Brahmins, the Araconians, and the natives of Nias and Chilo. Rumpelstiltskin, too, guarded his name. An ancient Egyptian document called the Memphite Theology goes further. It describes the creation of the world as a process by which the god Ptah, arising on the primeval mound of mud in the waters, thinks up each part of the world to be created, himself, the other gods, and all else, then brings it into material being by naming it. Thus were made all work and all crafts, the action of the arms, the movement of the legs, and the activity of every member of the body, in conformance with the command which the heart thought, which came forth through the tongue, and which gives the value of everything. So Ptah was satisfied, or rested after he had made everything. From Wilson, 1951. The very act of creation by naming had a special name, Hu, H-U, translatable as authoritative utterance. Such an utterance coming from the tongue of Ptah, or the Pharaoh, had so much power to make things happen that it too became personified as a willful being, Hu, along with its companion, Sia, the perception in the heart that precedes the pronouncement by the tongue. A rather similar statement of creation by naming comes from not far away in time and space. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." Genesis chapter 1, verses 3 through 6. And so forth until God rests. The naming makes things so. A still simpler version of the power of the word alone is, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." John chapter 1, verse 1. If the spoken word has such great power over the referent, then the notion of speaking a blessing or a curse takes on very potent meaning, promising great benefits and terrifying consequences. One can create or at least influence the future with one's mouth, whether for good or for ill. Note that knowing a name really does give one some special power over the person or thing with that name. Leonard Bloomfield, one of the founders of American linguistics, invites us to imagine Jack and Jill walking up the hill. When Jill sees an apple in a tree and realizes she is hungry, so she says a few words to Jack, who vaults the fence, climbs the tree, takes the apple, brings it to Jill, and places it in her hand. Jill eats the apple. Now, surely that's power. By moving her mouth a little, Jill got Jack to do all the work of getting her a meal. Once you have words, you can ask for things in their absence and work on the solutions to problems before they overwhelm you. So the basic observation that language has special power is not unfounded, even if most people would not agree that language provides a one-to-one match for reality in the way that Pata's creation myth might seem to imply. Knowing a person's name entrains some very particular powers, too. For one thing, calling people by name almost invariably makes them react to you, if only by turning to look. The use of one's personal name also elicits an emotional reaction, as you discover when someone gets your name wrong or makes jokes about the form of your name. Or try this. Next time you have to deal with a smarmy salesman, tell him your name is something else, and see how deliciously detached you feel when he uses it to try to close in on you. This power of the personal name, together with willfulness, may account for why so many objects, particularly in Germanic mythology, have proper names. Thor's battle hammer, Mjolnir, Heimdall's horn, Jol, the unbreakable fetter, Gleipnir, Odin's auger, Rati, and magic ring, Draupnir. It drops 8 rings like itself every 9 days. Roland's sword, Durendal, and horn, Oliphant. Oliver's sword, Haltclair. King Arthur's sword, Excalibur. And so on. All these objects have in common the trait that they do something. They have the power to smash, make noise, bind, pierce, reproduce, cut, and in the case of the weapons, kill. Like blessings and curses, this power was taken very seriously, and swords in particular seem often to have received a name when completed, as though, like children, they were now being launched into the world to do good or ill. How close this concept hovers to the willfulness principle can be seen from a very early depiction of a sword in the great rock-cut sanctuary of the Hittites at Yazlıkaya in Turkey, dated to about 1250 BC. Carved in high relief and perhaps 10 feet tall, the sword has a hilt composed of animals and a ribbed blade that appears to come out of or be stuck into the stone of the cliff. At the top of the hilt protrudes a male head wearing the peaked cap peculiar to Hittite deities, the divine spirit of this sword in the stone. The Bronze Age Hittites had a monopoly on the strange new metal iron, which differed from copper and tin, the components of bronze, in that it never occurred naturally as a metal except in rare meteorites, but always in the form of ore, stone. The highly superior, but far more difficult to produce, iron sword may thus have been perceived as the sword from X, the stone, and wandered off into the oral pipeline at an early date in a linguistic form as memorable and evocative as Goldilocks's porridge. Interestingly, the Hittites could obtain their iron only during the non-snowy season, apparently from the mountains east of the Black Sea. The resemblance of the name of the iron-smelting inhabitants of that area, the Chalbians, to the famous Arthurian sword in the stone, Excalibur, is striking. This and some other parts of the Arthurian legend have been shown to match Caucasian legends so exactly as to leave no doubt they originated there and moved to Britain with displaced soldiers serving Rome. Name magic forms part of a wider analogic phenomenon known as sympathetic magic, in which any resemblance or relation to the object of the magic can be employed, not just the name. Thus, in parts of the Caribbean and Africa, Pins stuck into a doll are intended to become real pain in a real person, whereas in Slavic areas, all knots in the house are untied to help release the baby for a woman in difficult labor. Similarly, Ovid recounts how Eleithyia, Greek goddess of childbirth, sat for days with her hands clasped over her crossed legs to prevent Alcmene from giving birth to Heracles. Alcmene's maid, recognizing this, ran to Eleithyia and excitedly announced the birth, causing the goddess to jump up in surprise and release her hold. Instantly, the child was born. The blurring of symbols and other representations with their reference constitutes part of a still broader phenomenon, the blurring of appearance and reality. Stage magicians work hard to entertain us with tricky appearances, but most of us leave the theater convinced we've been hoodwinked, even if we don't know quite how. Before literacy, however, the smallness of the database sometimes led to quite different results and expectations, a fact which medieval churchmen often exploited with artificially miraculous weeping Madonnas and the like. In particular, until very recently, a dream event was taken to be quite as real and potentially as important as a waking event. Today we know that dreams result from random neural firings in the brain, as the brain degausses itself during sleep, while the analytic hemisphere desperately tries to make the unconnected images cohere somehow. Remember the bird and the orange? But formerly, dream experiences were taken seriously. A text of 1893 tells us that the wife of a poor shoemaker in Jaroszewo, in today's Poland, died. On the day of the funeral, he wanted to be awakened early in the morning at 4 o'clock by his apprentice in order to run some errands for the funeral. The apprentice, however, overslept the time. Then the dead wife arrived exactly at 4 o'clock and boxed him on the ear 4 times with her ice-cold hand of death. Frightened, he awakened and jumped out of the bed. Note that we are not warned that the apprentice saw the woman in his dream. We are told that she arrived and boxed his ear, after which he woke up. The narrator presents her actions as being fully as real as the apprentice's, yet the woman was dead. Here's another such from Serbia. Jawica reports that his stepdaughter, by the name of Stanaka, lay down to sleep 15 days ago, fresh and healthy, but at midnight she started up out of her sleep with a terrible cry, fearful and trembling, and complained that she'd been throttled by the son of a haiduk, by the name of Milo, who had died 9 weeks earlier. And where did Stanaka, who died soon after, see this vampire? Not as Hollywood would have it, climbing out of a coffin in the graveyard, waving long bony fingers and a black cloak. She saw an acquaintance, recently deceased, attack her in her house as she slept. When we are awake and sober, we cannot see deceased people speaking and doing things, but we can and do when we are asleep. A not unreasonable conclusion, the souls of the dead can stick around, and we can see and talk to them in dreams. As an elderly Greek woman put it, at death the soul emerges in its entirety, like a man. It has the shape of a man, only it's invisible. It has a mouth and hands, and eats real food just like we do. When you see someone in your dreams, it's the soul you see. People in your dreams eat, don't they? The souls of the dead eat too. So the descendants may set out actual meals and other things for the deceased, further blurring the distinctions between the quick and the dead. These wandering spirits, however, must have at least some knowledge that we don't. At the very least, they will know what the spirit world is like, and will have met and conversed with other spirits. So people viewed dreams as an important source of information not available to us when awake. On the occasion of a drought, King Gudea, a powerful ruler in late 3rd millennium Mesopotamia, went to sleep in the temple in order to be instructed in a dream as to the meaning of the drought. Likewise, the Greek hero Bellerophon, according to Pindar, Olympian Ode 13, strophe 4, lay down for the night on the altar of the goddess Athena, who told him in a dream how to catch Pegasus. In the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, during the dangerous expedition to obtain cedar logs from the mountain guarded by the monster Humbaba, Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu repeatedly solicit dream messages from the gods. Gilgamesh dug a well before the setting sun. He went up the mountain and poured out fine meal on the ground and said, "O mountain, dwelling of the gods, bring me a favorable dream." Then they took each other by the hand and lay down to sleep, and sleep that flows from the night lapped over them. Gilgamesh dreamed, and at midnight sleep left him, and he told his dream to his friend, "Enkidu, what was it that woke me, if you did not? My friend, I have dreamed a dream. We stood in a deep gorge of the mountain, and suddenly the mountain fell, and beside it we two were like the smallest of swamp flies. In my second dream again the mountain fell. It struck me and caught my feet from under me. Then came an intolerable light blazing out, and in it was one whose grace and beauty were greater than the beauty of this world. He pulled me out from under the mountain. He gave me water to drink, and my heart was comforted, and he set my feet on the ground." Then Enkidu, the child of the plain, said, "Let us go down from the mountain and talk this thing over together. Your dream is good. Your dream is excellent. The mountain which you saw is Humbaba. Now surely we will seize and kill him, and throw his body down as the mountain fell on the plain." One purpose of talking to the spirits was to solicit advice, as when the Norse king or Slavic head of household would spend the night on his ancestor's grave. Another purpose was, of course, to obtain information about the future. In recent times, people have viewed the spirits as bringing this information unbidden and encoded in reverse, as in this case from rural Greece in the 1970s. Irini would discuss the dreams that she and her husband had seen prior to Eleni's accident. They now realized that these dreams had clearly foretold their daughter's death. One night, Irini had seen her daughter, dressed as a bride, leaving home in a taxi. As all the dream books say, dreams of weddings are ominous signs of impending death. A week before Eleni's death, her father had seen in his sleep a herd of black goats descending the hill toward his pens at the edge of the village. The dictum that dreams of marriage forebode death occurs already in that first dream book of European literature, Artemidorus's On the Interpretation of Dreams, 2nd century A.D. A millennium earlier, in a famous passage in the Odyssey, Homer's Penelope claims to see dreams merely as being true or untrue. "Stranger, dreams are intractable and hard to discern, nor are they always fulfilled for men. For double are the gates of fleeting dreams, the one constructed of horn, the other of ivory. And those dreams that come through the one of sawn ivory, they deceive, bearing unfulfilled words. Whereas those that come from the door of polished horn, they fulfill true things when mortals see them." Once the distinction between reality and appearance is thoroughly blurred, yet other things happen. When we paint a picture in our Western culture, we try to paint what we see, or at least we did until Picasso, Klee, and the like led us in new directions. If I, as your model, stand sideways so that one arm and shoulder are hidden from your view, you paint me that way. That is, unafraid of separating reality, I have two shoulders, from appearance, I seem to have only one. We traditionally paint how things appear to us, the appearance of reality. By contrast, the ancient Egyptian painter would depict both shoulders frontally of a person walking side view, painting what he knew was there even if he couldn't see it. Many children and some adults draw hands this way, with all five fingers always visible. Unable or unwilling to risk the isolation of appearance from reality, he painted his conception of what was there. As a matter of fact, cognitive studies have shown that this problem arises once again from brain structure. The analytic or left side of the brain instigates conceptual drawings, drawing what it knows to be there, whether visible or not, whereas the opposite side of the brain, which specializes in spatial relations rather than analysis, draws eidetically, draws what it sees. What this says about the thinking habits of the Minoans, who alone among ancient Mediterranean peoples drew eidetically, has not been investigated. Let us return now to myth itself, to those similes that lost their like, so that the descriptor has fused with the event or object. Some cases are stable. Lapis looks rather like night sky, and turquoise like daytime sky to anyone who sees them. In other cases, while the observable reality is stable, the culture has changed so much that the descriptor can no longer be understood. In Snorri Sturluson's tale of Thor's visit to the giant Utgard-Loki, the host challenges Thor to empty a drinking horn, saying, "We consider it good drinking if this horn is drained at one drink. Some men take two to empty it, but no one is such a wretched drinker that he can't finish it in three." Thor takes the horn and drinks for all he is worth, but to his disgust cannot empty it in even three tremendous draughts. Later, the giant catches up with Thor and his friends after they have left his hall and confesses that he had bested them by magic. "The other end of the horn was in the sea, but you didn't perceive that. And now when you come to the ocean, you'll see how much you have made it shrink." We might dismiss the tale as cute, even clever, but Snorri, who lived soon after Iceland accepted Christianity and who wrote his book to preserve for poets the meanings of the myths that traditional Icelandic poetry referred to, had one foot in each world, the literate Christian world and the largely non-literate heathen world, and he understood both symbol systems to a fair extent. So he keeps sticking in little translations for his Christian friends. Knowing that representation and referent have merged here too thoroughly for his audience, he tells us point blank at this juncture, "That is called the ebb tide now." We can see that possibility after Snorri tells us, but honestly, did you get it before? Too much of a gulf separates our cultures. Just because we don't understand something immediately doesn't mean it didn't have a solid meaning at one time. Nor is Snorri crazy. His other insertions, such as explaining Loki's writhing as earthquakes and things weeping for the death of Baldur as the condensation on cold objects, all depend on clear analogies. Now suppose, thanks to migration or the vastness of geologic and astronomical time, that the referent can no longer be seen, and only the descriptor remains. Those who have not experienced at first hand the terror of an eruption, major quake or tsunami, or a plague of locusts, or witnessed the marvel of a supernova so bright it shines in the daytime sky for weeks, as the Crab Nebula did in 1054 and others did earlier, can only take other people's word for what it is like. And this they may well misinterpret, even when they belong to the same culture. Fogging effect. Blurring of representation and referent is especially likely to occur when people no longer have direct experience of the referent. Consider yet again volcanic eruptions, but this time imagine the quieter kind, in which molten lava flows like water from a bubbling crater and runs down the side of the mountain. What does the lava look like if you know no geology? When it trails down the side of the mountain, perhaps like red stringy hair, such as that of the Sky Spirit's daughter, or maybe like snaky locks adorning the head of the mountain, as in Hesiod's account of huge Typhoeus, on whose shoulders writhed 100 snake heads with flickering tongues and fire flashing from the eyes. Theogony, 824-828. Or maybe like molten bronze being poured from the crucible. When it squirts straight up in a bright fountain, like a tall flashing sword blade, or a shower of gold. And what does it sound like? Sometimes it hisses, like snakes again. Sometimes it roars, like a lion or a monster in pain. It can also make sharp percussive sounds, like artillery or a smith pounding on his anvil, or tremendous footfalls. Hesiod reports of Typhoeus, "And voices were in all his terrible heads, producing every sort of unspeakable utterance. For one time they spoke so the gods understood, but at another in the voice of a proud bull bellowing loudly in ungovernable rage, and at another in that of a ruthless-hearted lion, or sometimes yelping like puppies, a marvel to hear, or hissing repeatedly, and the great mountains echoed with the sounds." And what is the crater like? If you can get close, you feel its overwhelming heat, as in a smithy. From a distance, you see only its glow, brightest at night. And since ancient Mediterranean peoples thought vision occurred by light coming out of the eye rather than into it, the volcano may be described as having a great eye. When Odysseus resents the inhospitableness of a giant with one great eye, who eats some of Odysseus's men and then hurls huge rocks at him as he tries to escape, we might at least suspect that we are hearing an old story of a volcano. The episode of Polyphemus, or wide-renowned, who is a cyclops, or round eye, begins with Odysseus seeing smoke rising from the land, and ends with Polyphemus breaking off the mountaintop and hurling it at Odysseus's departing ship. Many years ago, we watched the eruption of Mauna Ulu, a double cone on the side of Kilauea, from a point right on its rim, possible only on days with steady trade winds. Separate columns of magma fed twin lava lakes connected by a small channel and drained by a side vent from which streams of lava flowed down the mountain to a steamy meeting with the sea. The lakes below us roiled at 2,300 degrees Fahrenheit. As giant gas bubbles would raise the level of one lake, lava would cascade through a narrow corridor.